first book of Kings, chapter 17, about Elijah, who suddenly strides onto the story of Israel. Now Elijah the Tishbite, from Tishbe in Gilead, which is across Jordan, Transjordan, said to Ahab, the wickedest king of the northern kingdom, Ahab and his Jezebel, said to Ahab, after years of this man's idolatry and leading the whole of the 10 tribes in the north astray, said to Ahab, as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years, except by my word. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah, leave here, turn eastwards, and hide. Not the first, well, it is the first time, but he's going to hide another time, isn't he? Down in Sinai, Horeb. And hide in the ravine of Kerith, east of the Jordan. You will drink from the brook, and I will order the ravens to feed you there. So he did what the Lord had told him. He went to the ravine of Kerith, or Cherish, Cherith, east of the Jordan, and stayed there. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. Sometime later, of course, because of the drought, the brook dried up, because there had been no rain in the land. Then the word of the Lord came to him, go at once to Zarephath of Sidon, and stay there. That was away far north. I have commanded a widow in that place to supply you with food. So he went to Zarephath. When he came to the town gate, a widow was there gathering sticks. He called to her and asked, would you bring me a little water in a jar so I may have a drink? As she was going to get it, he called, and bring me, please, a piece of bread. As surely as the Lord your God lives, she replies. She's got the language, although she's from Sidon, notice. As surely as the Lord your God lives, she replied, I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. Or you could put the jug in the jar the other way if you like. I am gathering a few sticks, she said, to take home and make a meal for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die. Elijah said to her, don't be afraid. Go home and do as you have said. But first, notice this, first, make a small cake of bread for me from what you have, and bring it to me, and then make something for yourself and your son. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord gives rain on the land. So she went away and did as Elijah had told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and her family. For the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. Sometime later, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill. He grew worse and worse and finally stopped breathing. She said to Elijah, what do you have against me, man of God? Did you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son? Give me your son, Elijah replied. He took him from her arms, carried him to the upper room, the prophet's chamber, where he was staying, and laid him on his bed. Then he cried out to the Lord, O Lord my God, have you brought tragedy also upon this widow I am staying with by causing her son to die? Then he stretched himself out on the boy three times and cried to the Lord, O Lord my God, let this boy's life return to him. And the Lord heard Elijah's cry, and the boy's life returned to him, and he lived. Elijah picked up the child and carried him down from the room into the house. He gave him to his mother and said, Look, your son is alive. Then the woman said to Elijah, Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is the truth. Amen. May God bless to us his holy word. The Old Testament, the first book of Kings, chapter 17. In our long excursion through the kingship of Israel and Judah, we now come to perhaps the most towering figure in the Old Testament, Elijah. And we don't forget, do we, that Malachi prophesies him to come again. And we know that that refers prophetically to John the Baptist, who, as the last two verses of the Old Testament tell us, Malachi 4, 5 and 6, John the Baptist is the second Elijah, and very like him in character. Someone remarked last Sunday that it was astonishing, I think it was Professor John Duncan from Arkansas, last Sunday evening said he was astonished that two of the greatest prophetic figures in the Old Testament, Elijah and Elisha, belonged to the northern kingdom, which was pretty well a disaster from the beginning, from their breakaway until its people were carried away, you remember, bodily by the Assyrians in 722 BC. And John's implication was, I think, was that not a waste of good men in the north when Judah in the south could have profited from such colossal prophetical characters? But perhaps the northern kingdom would have collapsed much sooner than it did if it had not been for Elijah and Elisha. Interestingly enough, there is a reference in 2 Chronicles to Elijah sending a letter to Judah's king, Jehoram. But of course, that would have been because Jehoram married Ahab and Jezebel's daughter, Athaliah, from the north. And she was equally as wicked as her mother. But then so was her husband, Jehoram. Now, I'll read what Elijah wrote to Jehoram here in 2 Chronicles 21 and 12. Jehoram received a letter from Elijah the prophet, which said, "This is what the Lord, the God of your father David, says. You have not walked in the ways of your father Jehoshaphat, or of Asa, king of Judah, two good kings in the south, but you have walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, and you have led Judah and the people of Jerusalem to prostitute themselves, just as the house of Ahab did in their idolatry. You have also murdered your own brothers, members of your father's house, men who were better than you. So now the Lord is about to strike your people, your sons, your wives, and everything that is yours with a heavy blow. You yourself will be very ill with a lingering disease of the bowels until the disease calls your bowels to come out. The Lord aroused against Jehoram the hostility of the Philistines and of the Arabs who lived near the Cushites, the Ethiopians. They attacked Judah, invaded it, and carried off all the goods found in the king's palace, together with his sons and wives. This is how it happened. Not a son was left to him except Ahaziah, the youngest, and he became king, and he was just nearly as bad as his father. After all this, the Lord afflicted Jehoram with an incurable disease of the bowels. In the course of time, at the end of the second year, his bowels fell out because of the disease, and he died in great pain. His people made, notice this, his people made no fire in his honor as they had for his father's. Jehoram was 32 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 8 years, passed away in his 40th year to no one's regret, and was buried in the city of David, but not in the tombs of the kings. He was such a bad man. Of course, Elijah's chief concern, although he's writing this letter to the man in the south, the king in the south, his chief concern was in the north with Ahab and Jezebel. And it's extraordinary, you know, how this unknown Elijah from away across Jordan there in a remote village that nobody had ever heard of, Tishbe, suddenly strode forth and crossed the Jordan and confronted Ahab with the intelligence that the Lord whom he serves and before whom he stands declares that there will be no rain for the next few years except by my word. Then, under divine command, Elijah ran back across the Jordan and hid at the brook Kerith. Now, I hinted at this during the reading. Is there something about towering figures which makes them also paradoxically rather timid souls who want to run away and hide? You remember how Elijah later ran from Jezebel after Carmel, almost the length of the country, to Horeb, Sinai. So there at Kerith, the Lord looked after Elijah, providing water and food from the birds, although some scholars try to turn the word raven, of course they would, wouldn't they, into something else. Eventually, of course, the brook dried up with the drought, and the Lord sent Elijah away north to Lebanon, to Zarephath. And there, as the Lord prophesied, he encountered a widow and sought from her water and food. "What?" she said. "I've no bread, only a handful of flour in a jar with a little oil. And I'm gathering sticks to make a fire and cook our last meal before I and my son die. Not at all, said Elijah, not at all. You do as you say, but serve me first, and you will find that the flour and the oil will not run out until the Lord sends rain again. Was it cheek on Elijah's part to command the woman to put him first? As I was suggesting to the little ones, I don't think so. Not if he was who he said he was, namely, the man before the Lord, and in supreme command of things earthly in the meantime, for his God. And I think the woman sensed his authority, because she did his bidding. That's the wonderful thing. She obeyed him. And he lived with the woman and her son, so that they continued to feed on the undiminishing flour and oil. And it sounds almost idyllic, as well as miraculous, of course. Sounds rather idyllic, but things are never idyllic for long down here on earth, are they? Someone sees to that. Who is it? Is it God? Or the devil? How many are able accurately to discern the subtle interplay between God, between good and evil? Say that again. How many are able accurately to discern the subtle interplay between good and evil, and see where the evil is and where the good? Now, that's a fair question, but how shall we answer it? It isn't always God who is the answer, as we know. Who is the actor, sorry. It isn't always God who is the actor. But nonetheless, God must bear the ultimate responsibility for all that happens, mustn't he? For he is the sole creative source. The devil is a mere creature and is only able to imitate. He can't create anything. So who was it this time who caused the sun to sicken and die? Never mind. God can cope with it, because, of course, he copes with everything he permits. And the woman blamed Elijah. So, she said, in her anger, fury was it, dismay, hurt. That's the kind of man of God you are, you destroyer. Why did you come here? She stormed. To take away my son's life. Well, according to the fact that it was by Elijah's divine authority and the wasting not of the flour and the oil that she and her son had been kept alive during the drought, it was rather rich of her to say that, wasn't it? So, but of course, she was deeply distressed and had to blame somebody. So he took her lifeless son and went up to his prophet's chamber. And there he prayed. Now, you know, the interesting thing about the Old Testament is that Satan is seldom mentioned or even hinted at, as if they did not know about him at all. Now, this always intrigues me, as many of you know. And in the booklet on the bookstall here, sweeping through the Old Testament, I see the whole story of the Old Testament as determined by the verse Genesis 3:15, where the conflict between God and the devil is delineated, and where it says that the serpent will bruise the son's heel, but he will bruise the serpent's head. And you see, with a guide like that, sweeping right through the Old Testament. Yet, you know, when at Swanwick in 1968, I gave the addresses on the devil, which are incorporated in that other booklet here, entitled Biblical Teaching on the Devil, I was accused at Swanwick of reading the devil into the Old Testament. All over the place, they said, after my first address. But I was able to say to them, I wasn't reading the devil into the Old Testament. I was reading him out into the open, as I'm doing now. It was obviously by God's permission that the enemy of souls was allowed to strike the widow's son. God permitted. But you might say, what's God playing at? Well, you would hardly call it playing, for the Lord has always a serious purpose in view. There is nothing frivolous about him. But this purpose seems only to be concerned with this little household, these three people in this household. Yet, of course, as we know now, the whole world has heard of this incident ever since through the scriptures. So Elijah, having made his plea to the Lord to consider his situation, living in this house with this woman as God's man, her son sickens and dies. Lord, he says, you see how embarrassing this is for me. So he took the boy, attended to him by stretching himself on him three times and virtually commanding the Lord to let the lad's life return to him. And the Lord, as we read, heard him, and life returned to the lad. So he carried him down to his mother. Look, he said, your son is alive. And her response, now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is truth. That's an interesting statement, that the word of the Lord from your mouth is truth. I was preparing daily Bible readings this morning early, and I came to 1 Timothy 3:15, which says, 1 Timothy 3:15, Paul is writing to Timothy saying, if I am delayed, you will know how people ought to conduct themselves in God's household, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and foundation of the truth. So she's acknowledging now. Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is truth. But then, didn't she know that before? When, by Elijah's command, the Lord kept her and her son and Elijah alive by the flour and the oil. It's an intriguing question, isn't it? You see, our God has fascinating ways of working. Strange ways sometimes. He's not in a hurry. Now, that is one of the wisest things that was ever said to me in the early days of my ministry, when I tended to go at things, I suppose, like the proverbial bull in the china shop. It was said to me by old Miss Isabella Hunter, the lady who lived, you remember, to be 104 years old. I had been going on to her about the sweeping changes I wanted to see wrought in Gilcomston. And she listened. And then when I had finished, she just said to me so simply, "But you know, Mr. Still, God is not in a hurry." It was a broadside. It completely floored me. And I honestly think that it did me more good than anything I can recall having been said to me about the work in the early days. And I think that looking back, it was perhaps the beginning of a more philosophical approach to the Lord's work. Anyway, see how the Lord indoctrinates this widow. In two stages. She saw, when he first confronted her, that he was a man in authority. And so she complied with his wishes in preparing a meal for him first, before she did for herself and for her son. And so the three of them lived during, presumably, a fair proportion of the drought and famine for these 3.5 years. Apparently agreeably in the same house, and the flour and the oil did not fail. But then the boy's sickness and death. What about that? What faith she had in Elijah by his merciful action in preserving her larder didn't run, of course, to the death of her boy. Oh, no. That's a different kind of God from the provider. This God is a destroyer. You can't believe in a destroyer and go along with such terrible cruelty as taking away a poor widow's only son. Why did God do it? Or allow it? Faith in the goodness of God is never complete and fit to face the extremities of life until it has been dipped in death. Faith has to be dipped in death. William Cowper, although I suppose if you're English you'd call it Cooper, anyway, went through many living deaths in his tortured lifetime due to mental instability. But he was a wonderful hymn writer. You remember he wrote, "The dearest idol I have known, whate'er that idol be, help me to tear it from thy throne and worship only thee. So shall my walk be slow, be close with God. Calm and serene my frame, so pure a light shall mark the road that leads me to the Lamb. You see, a faith in God which sees him only as a fair weather God may not stand the test of trials, and very likely won't. Faith has to be tested. The Bible's very clear on that. Faith has to be tested. And indeed, as in the case of Job and this woman and many another, it is often those who have the brightest faith that God selects for further testing. You see that? So, this morning, by this lesson, we are all being challenged to examine our faith, to see how deep it is, how real it is, and whether it has ever gone through a death-resurrection experience to authenticate it as the real thing. And this woman's faith needed this test. And it is clear that she was so devastated by the boy's death that she blamed his death on both Elijah and Elijah's God for visiting her, already a widow, a poor widow, with one more personal tragedy, more than she felt she could bear. Now, this is what happened to Job. Well, as far as he was concerned, who else was there to blame, if you know the book of Job, who else was there to blame but God? Poor God gets all the blame. I'm afraid, you know, he has to take the blame for all the bad things which happen in his universe. Well, it's his universe, isn't it? It doesn't belong to another, and he is responsible for it, and there's a sense in which he must take the blame, although that's not the word. That's the truth, surely, isn't it? He's fully responsible. But his strokes of calamity, either by his own hand or by that of an unwilling but subservient agent, can only show the beginning of his purposes. You have to wait to see what follows the first terrible, devastating stroke. Wait on the Lord is the drill when you've received a blow and a knock and a hurt. Wait on the Lord. Wait to see what he will say about this. Therefore, while the first whining cry may not be stifled when the blow falls, after a little thought, there needs to be a waiting period to see what may follow the seemingly fatal stroke. Thomas couldn't believe in anything beyond Christ's death. He was stuck with Christ's death and couldn't see beyond it. Unless I see the marks on his hands, I will not believe. This woman had to see beyond the boy's death to his resuscitation. But she couldn't until it took place. Then, from the yonder side of her own crucifixion, the death of her boy, she saw that God was good. He was kind after all. Aye, but it's not always so. Not always so. We have fought in recent times in prayer for the lives of some of our dearest saints, until in certain cases, as in that of our beloved Rosemary Catenach that we were remembering last Sunday, and our dear church officer, we were obliged to accept that the Lord had need of them. James, like Rosie, had done his stint nobly for over 40 years, and it was time for him to go. And we had to accept that. His death was for real. There was to be no recovery, and Gilcomston would never be quite the same without that dear man. The test, you see, sometimes has to go the whole hog right through to permanent earthly bereavement. And God gives grace and faith for that, as we have seen so often. But we have to go through with the death to achieve it. And you remember that Paul speaks of this in connection with the Lord's Supper. This is what he says. Whoever eats this bread and drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of sinning against the body and the blood of the Lord. And that can only mean, you know, that not taking Christ's death seriously is a great sin. And he goes on, a man ought to examine himself before he eats of the bread and drinks of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without recognizing the body of the Lord and his death eats and drinks judgment on himself. And then he goes on to say what it may mean. That is why many among you are weak and sickly, and a number have fallen asleep in mortal death. What he's really saying is, we have to take Christ's death seriously, and therefore the possibility of our death seriously too. And as to those falling asleep in mortal death, I'm not sure whether Paul is suggesting there that some have died prematurely on account of their failure to recognize the death of Christ. But the thing which has cost us so dear here in our church is the fact that it is some of the choicest saints who have been taken, and we can hardly believe that they were taken in judgment. But the possibility is always there, as Paul says. Not that I think it is true of any of these we are thinking of, but you know, I have known people here whom the Lord has taken, and I have wondered if it was in judgment. Then Paul concludes this quotation about the Lord's Supper. If we judged ourselves, we would not come under judgment. But when we have to be judged by the Lord, he says, we are being disciplined so that we will not be condemned. Damned, in fact, is the word, with the Lord. You know, there is something supremely healthy about a proper contemplation of the cross. Supremely healthy. I know that the worship of some Christians tends to be of the order of a lament that the cross ever happened. But that's far from the right attitude towards it, isn't it? First, of course, we must face its stark reality, that that is what they did to our Lord so long ago, in all its physical horror. And he went through it physically, and in every other way, in order that we might go through it, certainly spiritually, although possibly in other ways too. And the effect of that is that thereafter, having gone through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ and known something of the experience of his death in our lives, as this poor woman did in the death of her son, we begin to live our lives in the bright shadow, notice the words I use, the bright shadow of the cross, so that it touches the whole of our lives and enables us to meet life's trials, its hurts, its disappointments, and even its bereavements with realism, and therefore with grace and faith and hope. As even John Greenleaf Whittier, the American poet, astonishingly says, that is astonishingly for him, he says this, "The solemn shadow of the cross is better than the sun. The solemn shadow of the cross is better than the sun." Now that's very profound from Whittier. But yet, I think it sums up, don't you think, what this widow of Zarephath discovered when the prophet handed her a living son. God is good. God is good, and all his crosses lead to blessings, although for some the blessings will be hereafter. But for many, of course, it is here and now. And even for those whose blessing is hereafter, who may soon be called away to be with the Lord, the contemplation of that before the Lord takes them with a humble spirit, able to bow under the imminent sentence of mortal death, can give a peace which in its poignancy and expectancy can be exquisitely beautiful. I was saying that the other Sunday when all the people were here, that one thinks more and more, and indeed looks forward more and more, to being away, to be with the Lord. Last Sunday evening, Andrew Bruce played the tune to the hymn, "Crossing the Bar." I hadn't heard it for ages, and it was such a blessing, as I recalled Alfred Tennyson's choice words. Let me read it to you. "Sunset and evening star, and one clear call for me, and may there be no moaning at the bar when I put out to sea. But such a tide as moving seems asleep, too full for sound and foam, when that which drew from out the boundless deep turns again home. Twilight and evening bell, and after that the dark. And may there be no sadness of farewell when I embark. For though from out our bourne of time and place the flood may bear me far, I hope to see my pilot face to face when I have crossed the bar. Beautiful for those on the verge of going to be with the Lord, but beautiful also for those who are yet to enjoy His grace and His power down here for yet a while. So it's the Whittier hymn we're going to sing, 513. 513 by John Greenleaf Whittier. O Lord and Master of us all, whate'er our name or sign, we own thy sway, we hear thy call, we test our lives by thine. It's in that hymn, in the fifth verse, that we have these two wonderful lines: the solemn shadow of thy cross is better than the sun.